Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Super Tuesday and Super PACs, the money and the Mad Libs. Don't worry, we'll make it all make sense. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Super Tuesday, the 6th of March, 2012. And we'll get to the campaign in a bit. But we begin today firmly in the world of commodities. Not only were stocks down today, the worst day they've had in a month and a half, but so too was gold and oil as well. Crude in New York dropped $2 a barrel today, sky high to merely high, you might say. Iran and the various what-if scenarios are the proximate cause, but at a major energy industry conference down in Houston, the people whose job it is to worry about oil prices are worried. Marketplace's Scott Tong is there. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
So you are in the center of the oil universe down in Houston today. What are the what's the collective wisdom down there about prices and stuff?
Well, when they talk about prices and uncertainty, the thing they say, first of all, is they're always dealing with geopolitical uncertainty. I mean, these oil guys, they don't get to choose where this stuff is. It happens to be under the deep ocean in the Middle East, Russia, North Africa, Venezuela. So that's the nature of the business to start out with. Right now, they are antsy about whether there's enough in the world, the supply. They're worried about tightness. And right now with Iran, there's talk of sanctions, boycotting Iran, the possibility of an Israeli attack. So that means Iran's 2 million plus barrels of oil every day are in question. I just spoke to Bhushan Bari at the energy consultancy IHS Cambridge Energy, and his technical term for all this is fear factor.
If there is a disruption in supply from Iran or from a wider Middle East region, we may not have enough spare capacity to cover that immediately. Nobody has at the moment suggested there'll be such a huge disruption, but people worry about bad things happening.
Of course, in the category of bad things, Kai, that could include a whole lot of things that folks here consider a little overhyped right now.
Yeah, but you look at the list of things that could happen, right? From Syria to Iran to whatever it is in the Middle East, they must have some scenario that they plan for. There's some worst-case scenario, right?
Well, there are a number of scenarios. A quarter of the world's oil ships through the Strait of Hormuz. So if there's an attack, Iran could try to block it. You know, that would cut off a lot of the world's oil. The most think that's kind of unlikely. Before that happens, some analysts think an attack could freak out the insurance companies that are insuring the ships, and that could drive up the cost and halt some of that traffic. Or if Iran counters by going after refineries in Saudi Arabia or natural gas facilities in Qatar that some are thinking about. I mean, those are all the what-if scenarios that they say, you know, that could drive up prices. Crude oil could go up $50 more, 40% higher than it is now.
Well, if they go, up that $50 a barrel from where they are right now, that puts them above record highs. And then what happens to this this recovery thing we have going on?
Well, I think it depends on how long that goes. I mean, I talked to a couple economists, and they say if it's a couple weeks of freakout, it may not have a long-term effect. But if it's longer than that, you're right. All bets are off in the global economy. The interesting thing economists say is high prices for a long period of time tend to kill demand in the long term. You know, if gas at the pump is $4, $5, people tend to change their behavior. They drive less. They buy more efficient cars, which might push prices down in the long term. And there's already talk of that at this conference. The overused word in a lot of these sessions is energy supply revolution. That there's a lot of new technology, which means companies can get a lot of it out of the ground and supply can outrace demand. So that's a longer term question going forward.
Marketplace is Scott Tong down in Houston, Texas for us. Scott, thanks a lot.
All right. You're welcome.
On Wall Street today, the aforementioned worst day in a good long while. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's not likely today's Super Tuesday primaries are going to nail anything down in the race for the GOP nomination. All indications are there's plenty of politicking yet to do, which means just as the fight isn't over, neither is the fundraising. From Washington Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more.
In a world where candidates just won't go away, ever, we bring you Primezilla, no end in sight.
That's voiceover artist Ben Patrick Johnson, who I asked to give a movie take on the Republican presidential primary. We might not get any clear answers today about the state of the race, but the candidates have said they'll keep campaigning, and that means their fundraisers will go into overdrive. Why? Advertising.
I think it's safe to say that among the happiest people in America today are the owners of radio and television stations in key Republican primary states.
Trevor Potter is a former chair of the Federal Election Commission.
The big driver of expenses at this point will be radio and television.
At this point, places like California, New York, and Illinois don't usually matter in Republican primaries, but they are huge media markets with big delegate halls, so now they matter a lot. Plus, California is a winner-take-all state. Mike Duhaime is a Republican strategist.
Let's put it this way. You could probably run in Iowa, you know, a very robust television campaign statewide for $2 to $3 million. In California, you'd be talking about $15 to $20 million.
Duhaime says super PACs can raise that kind of money practically overnight.
There's an old saying, candidates never stop running for president, they just run out of money.
Not anymore, with so much outside advertising money. Steve Ansola-Behar teaches politics at Harvard. He says donors might experience fatigue if the primary contest goes on too long.
One fear for the Republicans is that they will have spent so much money attacking each other and campaigning against each other that, especially the super PAC donors, they just get tapped out.
He says mudslinging in super PAC ads may not be what a candidate wants, and there's the fear that mega donors would have too much influence. But for now, there's just going to be a lot more ads.
This election, vote super PAC for president.
So sit back and pop some popcorn and maybe get out your checkbook. I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace, and I approve this message.
I don't know if you remember this, but last year there was kind of an interesting series on the television game show Jeopardy! Watson, the computer developed by IBM, took on Jeopardy! Champions in a special three-day contest. Watson won by a lot. But then is when things started getting interesting. Watson started getting job offers. The first were in healthcare. But now he, or it, looks to be heading to Wall Street. Citigroup has signed Watson up to see if she, or it, can improve customer service and risk management. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more now on Watson's new gig.
Watson can read 200 million pages in 3 seconds. But how can reading really fast help Citigroup? I put that question to IBM's Manoj Saxena. Here's his sales pitch for the supercomputer.
Imagine if your company had the answers to all the questions that your employees and your customers may have.
That's some big talk. But Saxena says he can back it up. Watson can crunch data from sources ranging from earnings reports to blogs to customer comments and use them to answer questions like, what's the best credit card for me?
Watson is the beginning of a new class of computers that understand human language and provide suggestions and recommendations.
Equity analyst Ed McGuire with CLSA estimates that in just a few years, Watson could generate $2.5 billion of revenue for IBM.
To manage risk and help companies go after the decisions that require enormous amounts of data, it's a pretty attractive opportunity.
But Watson isn't foolproof, says Stephen Baker, author of Final Jeopardy, a biography of Watson.
Watson's genius is that it can answer anything, but only at certain levels of confidence.
Baker says Watson's answers are educated guesses based on probabilities, so caution could be in order, especially if banks start using Watson for things like risk assessment. And if Jeopardy's Daily Double is any indication, Watson has an appetite for risk.
Now, Watson, although you have but $400, you know, of course, that you can risk up to the maximum value of a clue on the board, and that is $1,000.
$1,000, please.
Hubris 2.0? Well, maybe not. He got it right. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The Canadian oil pipeline company TransCanada said today it's going to be ready in a couple of weeks to submit a new proposal for the Keystone XL pipeline. They're going to pick a route that avoids environmentally sensitive areas downhill that helped torpedo an earlier plan. That will surely mean more discussion of Canadian oil sands and whether they're worth the energy it takes to get that oil out. But there is a different energy fight brewing in a different part of Canada over hydroelectric power. Canada has $50 billion in new hydro projects proposed or under construction and plans to ship a lot of that electricity to the U.S. Unlike the oil sands, hydro is renewable, but it's not necessarily green. Emma Jacobs reports now from Labrador.
Roberta Benefiel is sitting on a rock overlooking the Churchill River in central Labrador, a rural scenic region of northeast Canada. She has a picture of her parents sitting on this same rock, and now she's looking out over the same waterfall that's in the photo. She's wistful. These rapids will disappear if a planned dam on this site gets built.
And the destruction that's going to be caused if this project goes ahead. I don't know what else to say. I could cry.
It's the familiar dam controversy. On the one side, power-hungry consumers. On the other, environmentalists bemoaning the loss of a wild river. But here's a twist, the first twist. Labrador has just 30,000 people in a region the size of Arizona. So this project's not for the locals. It's not even just for the neighbors.
We look at this project as being an important source of renewable energy for northeastern North America.
Gilbert Bennett works for Nalcor, the energy corporation leading this dam construction project. He says the dam will supply renewable energy to the whole province, but up to 60% of it could be exported to the United States. Which brings us to twist number two. Importing Canadian hydroelectricity could destroy another fragile ecosystem.
You could pretty much wipe out any investment in renewable resources.
Carol Murphy is executive director of the Alliance for Clean Energy New York. Right now, there's a move away from nuclear power and coal to renewables. Many states have passed laws that require a certain amount of electricity must come from renewables, solar, wind, biomass. In New York, it's an ambitious 30% by 2015. But if Canadian Hydro counts towards that clean energy goal, it could undercut investment in other domestic energy projects. That's because, according to Dan Dolan, who heads the New England Power Generators Association, it could really hurt the price of electricity.
That's going to really crater that price and send it very far down and really eliminate an incentive for a lot of developers to come in and try and develop new sources of power generation within the region.
Everything has impacts. You know, a careful process would think it all through.
Philip Raffles works with the Low Impact Hydro Institute, an organization that sorts out good dams from bad in terms of impacts on neighbors and the environment. He thinks the dam in Labrador could cost more than it brings in benefits, but
there's a lot of energy in that water, and it's certainly worth looking at if that's the right answer.
Raffel says the key thing is that all dam projects are different. He hopes that in the long run, more U.S. states will buy their power from lower-impact dams, regardless of location, because even if new hydro pours across the border, it's still, he says, just a drop in the bucket. In Labrador, I'm Emma Jacobs for Marketplace.
Coming up,
can we risk an America run by insert opponent's name? He clearly doesn't understand that America is built on hard work, not insert opponent's previous occupation.
Super PAC ads as Mad Libs, but first, let's do the numbers. Well, we haven't seen a day like this in a while, gang, and I don't mean that in a good way. The Dow Industrials erased 1.5% this Tuesday, 203 points. Closed at 12,759. The NASDAQ wiped out 1.3%, 40 points, 29.10 at the bell. The S&P 500 deleted 1.5%, 20 points, finished at 1,343. Those were the first triple-digit losses since November. Financials led the descent. Morgan Stanley sheared off 5%. Citigroup unpacked 4.67%. Goldman Sachs is missing 4% from the open. Metals were looking a lot less precious. Ditto for mining company stocks. Giant Freeport-McMoRan fell 2.5% today. Newport Mining threw off 1.25%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.95%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Labor Department releases its revised report on productivity and costs for the fourth quarter. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to issue consumer credit data for January. And let's hear it for your neighborhood. The Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry holds a hearing on healthy food initiatives, local production, and nutrition. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. When we were in Atlanta this weekend for the show yesterday, we did a roundtable with a group of seniors at Emory University. We talked mostly about jobs and the election and what it's been like to be in school for 4 years alongside a really weak economy. But right at the end, we digressed for a bit into student loan debt and how big a deal it was for them. Turns out it's a pretty big deal. Here's part of the conversation that didn't make the show yesterday. Computer science and engineering major Reginald Extra.
I'm definitely worried. Like, I can't lie. I'm graduating with pretty heavy student loans. I just feel that maybe that's also why my push is to get a job so hard and, you know, make sure I have something lined up, because at the end of the day, I don't want to be in a position where it's these heavy bills and I came to the school to get all these loans and I didn't get a job out of it to pay it back.
Reggie Extra at Emory University this past weekend. Turns out that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York knows exactly how he feels. It's out with a new report that says, once you add in however much Reggie owes, this country's collective student loan bill is now $870 billion. That's more than our total credit card debt. And it's a burden not just on recent graduates. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
Today's new college grads are so burdened with student loan debt, they're putting off key life decisions. They're moving back in with mom and dad, postponing buying that first new car or getting an apartment. Jack Jennings is founder of the Center on Education Policy.
They won't be buying furniture. They won't be renting apartments or buying condos. And so it'll have a ripple effect throughout the entire economy.
The furniture store sells fewer futons. Electronics stores don't sell as many TVs. The ripples from student debt swelled to a tsunami when they hit the housing market, toppling sales figures for first-time buyers. Rick Palacios is a senior research analyst at John Burns Real Estate Consulting. He says in 2009, 50% of all existing home sales were to first-timers. Now it's about 30% and dropping. Palacios says that has a ripple effect of its own on what he calls move-up buyers.
A move-up buyer typically counts on a first-time home buyer for them to sell their home and purchase a bigger home, purchase a nicer home.
And even if new debt-laden grads want to buy a new home, they may not qualify for a loan. Mike Ryan is with American Student Assistance, a nonprofit that helps people manage student debt.
Somebody has passed due for a long period of time or defaults on a loan obligation, it will certainly be a red flag for the bank.
The New York Fed says as many as 27% of student loan borrowers are delinquent. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The Chevy Volt has won one of the car industry's most prestigious awards. The electric hybrid has been voted Car of the Year at the Geneva Motor Show, which opened today. The Volt's not winning any prizes where it counts most, though. At dealerships, sales have been feeble, and adding insult to injury, GM announced the other day it's temporarily stopping production to work off a backlog. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more.
We've reached a moment everyone is waiting for. Do you feel the tension in the air?
Okay, it's not the Oscars, but the European Car of the Year award is a big deal for the auto industry. And for the second year in a row, says analyst David Bailey, a battery-operated vehicle has swept the board.
People making the awards love electric cars. It was a Nissan Leaf last year, it's a Chevy Volt this year. Technologically, of course, a fantastic achievement.
A car that can go up to 40 miles before it uses any gas at all. That's an American revolution.
Trouble is, the Volt is not sparking much fervour among car buyers on either side of the pond. Fewer than 8,000 sold last year. Bailey says it's the sticker price that's put a brake on sales, more than $30,000.
You can buy a Chevy Cruze that's the same size and half the price, so you can see why people aren't buying it. It's too expensive.
GM has now got such a surplus of Chevy Volts, it's halting production for 5 weeks. The company says it'll know by May whether the car will survive. It should, says Peter Wells of the Centre for Auto Industry Research.
It's a very good product. They'll benefit enormously from the learning in terms of using this product and improving it. And they will have established at least a presence in this market, which will probably do them well in the longer term.
And he says the accolade European Car of the Year may just persuade GM not to pull the plug on the Volt. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
President Obama had a press conference today, conveniently, as Republicans in 10 states were voting in GOP primaries. The stated topic of his remarks was a new way to help homeowners refinance their mortgages. But forget about the foreclosure crisis for a second and think about rent. Housing prices are overall low, but rent in a lot of cities is high and rising. What that means for income and well-being and life in general is the subject of a new book out today by Slate business and economics correspondent Matthew Iglesias. It's an e-book called The Rent is Too Damn High, What to Do About It, and Why It Matters More Than You Think. Matthew, thanks for being with us.
It's good to be here.
This book is omnibus is too strong, but it's you roll a whole lot in here, right? There's a lot that's tied up in the price of where we pay to live.
Yeah, and I think it's common sense. When people talk about their own lives and their family and their friends, everybody knows that housing costs are a big determinant of what you do, and everyone knows that which city you live in is a really big deal.
Let's stipulate the title of this book is true. The rent is too damn high. Let's just, for the sake of argument, assume that it is, because in some places it is and in some places it isn't. But if it is, why does it matter? What difference does it make?
Right. The pattern that I noticed is that when you talk about international migration, we take for granted that people move from poorer countries like Mexico to wealthier countries like the United States. So you might think that internally you would see people moving to the highest income, highest wage cities, but they actually don't. Instead, the population movement has been all to places like Phoenix, places like Las Vegas. That's because of the housing availability and the housing costs. And so we've got a problem over a period of decades now where people are not able to move to the highest wage, most prosperous parts of the country.
Well, let's flesh out that answer a little bit. And I'll go to the subtitle of the book. It's The Rent is Too Damn High, What to Do About It, and here's the nut graph, if you will, why it matters more than you think. I mean, obviously, high rent, it's a problem, but make it make more sense.
Well, for one thing, it just reduces the real wages that people are able to make. And it also matters for working class occupations, that if you're talking about working in the kind of face-to-face personal services that can't be outsourced to China, then it really matters if you can gain access to the most vibrant labor markets in the biggest, most prosperous cities, or if you're sort of stuck in a place where the local industry is declining and there's therefore not good opportunities for you.
The policy response in a lot of cities, New York comes obviously to mind, is rent control. Is that necessarily the answer?
Rent control can play an important role. But if we want to expand the number of opportunities that are available to Americans on the whole, then you have to look beyond rent control. And you really have to look at expanding the supply of housing stock in a given area. We have the technology to build denser, to build more apartment buildings. We don't use it because there's zoning restrictions and there's rules against doing the building. But if you look at these high-cost cities, the majority of the price of the house is the price of the permission to build, not actually the price of constructing the buildings.
The counterargument from a policy perspective, of course, is market forces are what market forces are. And you know, if you can't afford to live there, don't live there.
Right. Well, it is a question of market forces, but it's a question of market forces colliding with regulatory forces. What market forces ought to do is say, let's take the most expensive land and let's build the tallest, densest buildings on it. When you say, no, you're not allowed to do that, then market forces say, no, you've got to go live someplace else.
Where do we go then from here? I mean, what is housing policy going to be as we get, you know, the housing market recovering and more people trying to get jobs in cities and all of that?
Well, you know, I think mayors looking at job creation in the short term in their cities really ought to see deregulation of the real estate development market as a huge win. If you let people build in the places where it's most expensive, you could have a huge surge in the short-term construction employment. Looking to the longer term, I think that part of the revamping of the mortgage finance system has to be making it more friendly to cities, to density, and to high-value development.
Matthew Iglesias, he covers business and the economy for Slate. His new book is called The Rent is Too Damn High. Matthew, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
There's been no shortage lately of stories about the money and the politics of the 2012 election cycle. We've done it here. Everybody has. Because, to be fair, presidential election years can be big business, as Bree Benishore was telling us earlier. Especially this year, super PACs. So today, on Super Tuesday, from political cartoonist Mark Fiore, the Mad Lib version of the 2012 campaign.
Can we risk an America run by insert opponent's name? He clearly doesn't understand that America is built on hard work, not insert opponent's previous occupation. Sure, now he says he opposes hot-button issue news clip, but he used to support hot-button issue grainy footage with dead politician.
Opponent's name is called negative adjective for America and an apocalyptic noun for our future. He and his organization, Adverb Attack, because he is an adjective synonym for liar. He claims to be an positive noun, but is nothing more than a adjective body part negative noun. Around here, that down-home metaphor just don't verb. Better ask yourself, can America risk insert opponent's name? Paid for by Uplifting Verb Our Future. Another super PAC with so much expletive secret money, it's expletive adjective.
Mark Fiore is a Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist. We've got the video of that cartoon, by the way, animation to go with the words, on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, September 15th, 2008, was 3 years, 5 months, and 21 days ago. It's a somewhat relevant date in the economy of our times. Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy that morning. Today, the company, what's left of it more like, got out from under Chapter 11 and said it's going to start paying back its creditors next month. You can, should you so choose, by the way, buy shares in Lehman Brothers Holdings, Inc., 2.5 cents apiece. That's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Super Tuesday. Today, the Dow dropped 203 points, 1.5%. The NASDAQ off 40 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 down 20 points, about 1.5%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeed. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.